This is Audible.
Audible Frontiers presents White Trash Zombie Apocalypse, written by Diana Rowland, narrated by Allison McLemore. Chapter 1. Rain. Lots of it. Not yet, but soon. I hadn't heard a forecast, and I sure as hell wasn't psychic, but I'd lived in southeastern Louisiana all my life and felt the coming downpour in my bones. Of course, the really dark, ominous clouds helped a bit, too. But that was nothing. Not with zombies roaming the streets of Tucker Point. Several shuffled along the sidewalk, and a dozen or so huddled together, gruesome and shabby, in front of the Sundown Cafe. One taking a drag from a cigarette through cracked and bloody lips. Apart from the nearby movie crew, the cigarette was a sure sign these were zombie wannabes and not the real thing. No self-respecting zombie would be caught dead smoking. Caught dead, I snorted. But the truth was that zombies were some of the cleanest living people I knew. Had to be, since anything bad for you like cigarette smoke, drugs, or alcohol used up precious brains to detoxify the body. And if you didn't get more brains quickly, you'd start to rot. Not fun. I've been a pill-popping alcoholic smoker before I was turned. Now the most toxic substance I consumed was coffee. Well, mostly. Every now and then I still took a quick drag for old time's sake. I drove slowly, watching with roll-my-eyes amusement as the crew filmed a couple of fake zombies shambling after a shotgun-wielding woman. No stereotypes here. No siree. The majority of the movie-related activity seemed to be taking place at the back of Tucker Point High School, where school had let out for the summer a week earlier. A couple of 18-wheelers were pulled up in the lot on the side, and I saw movie people and equipment all over the blocked-off street ahead as well as on the school grounds to the left. The cop at the end of the street pulled the barricade aside without my having to flash my badge. My coroner's office van was plain black with no markings, but he'd probably been on enough death scenes to know the routine well enough to expect me. His face registered recognition, and he gave me a friendly wave as I passed through. I gave a polite hand lift in response, but had no clue if I'd ever seen him before. It was probably a lot easier for cops to remember the scrawny little blonde chick who worked as a body snatcher for the coroner's office than for me to remember one cop's face in a sea of identical uniforms. I proceeded slowly, trying to get a good look at the movie hoopla without obviously gawking or running into anything. Parked against the curb about a half block down was a white SUV with St. Edward's Parish Sheriff's Office crime scene emblazoned across the side, and right behind it the black Dodge Durango that belonged to Darrell Cusimano, the death investigator I was partnered with. As I parked behind the Durango, a tall woman with brunette hair, bound up in a severe bun and wearing a sheriff's office t-shirt, walked up to the SUV. Maria, a crime scene tech. As I climbed out of the van, she gave me a smile and a thumbs up to let me know she was finished with her work. I returned the smile and gave an acknowledging wave. With rare exceptions, a crime scene tech had to take photos and process any death scene in case there was a need later on to review the specifics. The actual removal of the body came last, after the techs did their stuff and the detectives had a good look at everything. I'd been collecting bodies from all sorts of death scenes for a while now, so I was pretty used to the routine. The techs appreciated that I stayed out of their way while they worked, and in return they let me know the instant I could get on with my own business. I moved to the back of the van, pulled the stretcher out, and lumped a body bag and a couple of sheets on top, then looked around for my hard-to-miss partner, a big, bald black guy with muscle to spare. He'd been an LSU linebacker 10 or so years back and still looked every bit the part. I spied him striding across the street toward me with a notepad in his hand. He'd probably been here a while already, gathering information, taking notes, and speaking to detectives and witnesses.
"Perfect timing," he said after he reached me. "Maria finished processing the scene only a couple minutes ago."
"Yep, she gave me the go-ahead," I replied, then swept my gaze around the area with its bustling activity. Crew members carted fancy equipment here and there. Men and women scrambled over set pieces, painting, nailing, clamping, and cutting. A man with deep lines of stress around his eyes consulted the stack of papers on his clipboard and gave instructions, accompanied by a lot of arm-waving, to the crew. Apart from the one scene with the shotgun, there wasn't any actual filming going on in the blocked-off street, but the behind-the-scenes stuff made up for it.
and there were fake zombies everywhere. Only about 10 or so wore full makeup, but the rest sported the equivalent of spray-on tan, except instead of sun-kissed bronze, it was decay gray. "This is too cool," I said. Darrell's mouth twitched. He knew perfectly well I wasn't talking about the body I'd come to pick up. "So what you got?" I asked. A grimace flashed over his face.
"Freak accident. Support pole on some scaffolding fell as our Mr. Brent Stewart was walking by, and he got beamed right in the skull."
He gestured with his head toward a cluster of trailers and headed that way. I followed, towing the stretcher in my wake as we passed through the trailer area, then toward a sidewalk that ran in front of a stucco building at the back of the school grounds. Near the corner of the building, the body of a white middle-aged man lay sprawled face down on the ground beside a structure of pipes and plywood about 20 feet long and at least that tall. Part of a set, I realized, upon seeing the painted facade, a cleverly rendered perspective of one side of the school, but looking far nicer than the school appeared in reality. A 2-inch diameter pipe lay beside the man, along the length of his body and with a few feet to spare. Blood and hair clung to it in a pattern that perfectly and morbidly matched the large dent in the back of his skull. Well, hell. I wrinkled my nose at the mess the pole had made of his head, then peered back up at the set piece. Now I saw the twisted clamp near the top.
"Yeah," Darrell said with a shake of his head. "Looks like he was in the totally wrong place. The clamp broke, the pole fell, and smack. Probably never felt a thing. Not even time for an oh shit."
I made an appropriately sympathetic wince. A part of me thought that it was probably a good way to go, never feeling a thing and never knowing. Yet at the same time, he never had a chance to say goodbye to his family and friends, even in his head. Death was really goddamn unfair sometimes. I crouched by the body, taking it all in, then looked around. We were behind a half dozen trailers, probably for makeup and such, and away from the general activity I'd encountered near the street. A few crew members carrying fake body parts passed us as though nothing had happened and headed toward the high school, and several extras in fresh-from-the-grave clothing but no makeup clustered at the back of the furthest trailer, casting anxious glances our way. "A zombie movie," I muttered. "That's too weird." Darrell nodded.
"Shambling? Brains, the whole thing," he replied, holding back a chuckle. Laughing and joking weren't considered cool on a death scene. "Saw a segment on the news about it last night. High school zombie apocalypse," he said, showing as much smile as he dared. "With 2 exclamation points.
"Too weird," I repeated with a roll of my eyes as I pulled on gloves. This certainly wasn't the first time a movie had been filmed in the area, but as far as I knew, it was the first one with zombies, and my first time anywhere near the action. In the past few years, Louisiana had been dubbed Hollywood South because of the growing film industry in the state. Movies and TV shows filmed here benefited from generous tax credits and were great for the local economy, and it was always a kick to see local sites show up on the big screen. It somehow made the people here feel as if they were really part of something bigger. I retrieved a sheet from the stretcher and wrapped up the poor guy's sadly smushed head. Though I'd eaten brains only a few hours earlier, I still had to use a good dose of willpower to keep from giving in to the delicious scent and digging a glob of brain out of the cracks in the skull to stuff into my mouth. That would probably go over even worse than laughing. Close to 10 months as a morgue tech van driver for the St. Edward's Parish Coroner's Office, and I actually felt like I knew what I was doing. That was also the same length of time that I'd been a zombie, but I had a feeling it would take me a lot longer to really get a handle on that lifestyle. I'd been an unemployed pillhead loser, with felon and high school dropout to pad out my resume, when I woke up in the ER after a night of drinking and drugs. Even though I had a fairly clear memory of being horribly injured in a car accident, I didn't have a mark on me, or a stitch of clothing, for that matter. Waiting for me had been a 6-pack of weird brown sludgy drinks and an anonymous note about a job waiting for me at the coroner's office, along with the threat of jail time if I didn't take the job. Took me a few weeks to figure out the truth.
that not only would I rot and fall apart if I didn't eat brains, but also that if I hadn't been turned into a zombie the night of the accident, I would have died on the spot from the combination of drug overdose and injuries. Though I'd only taken the job with the coroner's office because it was better than going to jail, I quickly grew to enjoy it, and not simply because it gave me easy access to the brains I needed. It was interesting, challenging without being a pain in the ass, and paid better than any job I'd ever had. Ever. Plus, I had some pretty awesome co-workers. With Darrell's help, I got the dead guy wrestled into the body bag and onto the stretcher. Once I had him in the van and the doors closed, I decided to take a few minutes to gawk some more at the movie stuff. What the hell? It wasn't every day I had the chance to see something like this. I locked the van, then crossed the street to get a better view as a stunt zombie practiced a fall from a third-story window to the airbag cushion below. Further down the street, several zombie extras mauled an actor in a cop uniform, then backed up and started over, repeatedly. Gotta get those shambling horde subtleties down for the camera. I smiled and shook my head. Though I'd watched several zombie movies and TV episodes after I was turned, I couldn't manage much love for most of them since the majority were about escaping from or killing mindless zombies. Needless to say, I had a hard time getting into that sort of thing. A white van marked Midnight Productions pulled up to the curb, and a too perky red-haired guy wearing an electric blue tracksuit climbed out of the passenger side, carrying a clipboard and plastic grocery bag. He tooted a whistle, then proceeded to call names and pass out white-wrappered snack bars to the extras who came out of the woodwork. Roll call and check marks on the clipboard. I figured some fine print contract clause said the movie people had to provide mid-morning protein or granola or some crap like that. Hell, maybe I can go hungry a few days and get cast as an extra, I thought with amusement. It was beside the point that if I was falling apart enough to look like a zombie, I'd be so hungry I'd crack open the head of the first person who walked by in order to get my fill of brains. Now that would be a realistic movie. Only a few months ago, I'd learned that it was a parasite that made a real zombie a zombie, and that parasite depended on brains to survive. Along with survival, it used brains to keep its host, like me, alive and in top physical condition in order to be a strong, ideal home. Without enough of the food it needed, human brains and the prions within them, the primary need took over, breaking down and using host tissue in a way that closely resembled corpse rot. A hungry zombie looked and behaved a hell of a lot like the stereotype and would do anything to get brains. Hungry zombie. Instant movie extra with a really bad attitude. I missed breakfast and now I've lost my appetite for lunch. I looked over at the speaker to see Detective Ben Roth sweep a gaze over the faux zombie action, a grimace of distaste twisting his features. He'd shaved off his scraggly mustache a couple of weeks ago, and I still wasn't used to it, though I definitely thought it had been the right decision. Ben was a homicide detective with the St. Edward's Parish Sheriff's Office, and even though Mr. Brent Stewart's death was most likely the accident it appeared to be, procedure stated that a detective still had to investigate. I liked working with Ben on scenes. He was friendly, easygoing, and took his job seriously without being uptight. Working with his partner, Mike Abadi, wasn't nearly as enjoyable. Abadi and I had pretty much agreed to disagree on, well, just about everything. What, rotting flesh doesn't get your appetite going? I teased. Ben gave a mock shudder. I can't get into the zombie thing. Freaks me out. That surprised me. Tall and stocky, he didn't look like someone who'd be easy to freak out. But I've seen you on gory and disgusting crime scenes, and you never even bat an eyelash. I never said it made sense, he replied with a laugh. It's like those horrible lifelike dolls. I know they're fake, but they still give me the heebie-jeebies. Well, lifelike dolls are creepy as hell, I agreed. My niece has one of those, he said, shuddering again. I'll take a fake zombie over that plastic monstrosity. Then he shook his head. Hell, I'll take a real zombie over that thing. I laughed, though I knew he had no idea why I found it so funny. He opened his mouth to speak, then frowned as a breeze brought a scattering of raindrops.
I think that was a warning shot from the coming weather, he said, or maybe a sign I need to get started on my paperwork.
With a parting smile, he turned and headed back to his unmarked car. The drizzle stopped as quickly as it had begun, but I knew Ben was right. The black clouds to the west rolled steadily closer. Heading back across the street, I pulled out my phone and started texting, "Did you know a zombie movie was being filmed here?" to my cop, not quite boyfriend, and fellow zombie, Marcus. At least that's what I'd tried to do. I barely had "Did you know" thumbed in when I caught movement out of the corner of my eye. A hell of a lot of very fast movement headed straight for me in the form of a dark silver pickup. The useless thought flashed through my head that nobody should be driving over 5 miles an hour beyond the barricade, and a glimpse of the driver's pissed, distracted face told me he didn't give a shit. I wasn't tanked up enough with brains to have zombie super speed and spent a precious split second coming to that conclusion. This is really gonna hurt, I thought as my body finally shifted into get the hell out of the way mode far too late. I reflexively braced for the impact of the truck, but something else slammed into me from the side, tackling me out of the path of the oncoming vehicle and to the pavement. My right shoulder popped with a sharp pain as I landed hard with about 200 pounds of someone on top of me. Distantly, I heard a screech of tires and the crunch of metal as Mr. Scowley's joyride abruptly ended. For an instant, I assumed Darrell had been the one to save my butt from becoming a temporary speed bump, except that he was closer to 300 pounds and would have squished little old me like a bug on a windshield. I shifted to see who my savior was and froze. Blue eyes set in a rugged face, framed with short blonde hair. I'd never forget those eyes, that face, ever. It was Philip, the soldier I'd been forced to turn into a zombie 6 months ago when creepy Dr. Christy Cherish held me captive in her secret lab. Part of her super zombie soldier, Zolgers, project. The last time I'd seen him was when I'd attempted to escape through ductwork the day after I turned him. He'd hauled me out and thrown me about a dozen feet. He'd been strong, even for a zombie, and he had looked like a movie zombie then, one eye clouded over, his ear hanging off and lips cracked away from his teeth, coupled with the unmistakable rotting zombie stench. That had been really bad news, since he'd eaten plenty of brains the day before and shouldn't have rotted that quickly. I'd spent the last half year wondering what the hell had gone wrong with him. More of Dr. Cherish's messed up experiments, no doubt. I took in the sight of him in a flash. He looked a lot better now, almost normal, except for a faint gray cast to his skin. Philip? I managed to gasp out right before he scrambled up and off me. I clutched at him, but my fingers closed on air as he turned and sprinted away. Before I could do more than sit up, he ducked between two trailers and was gone. What the hell? Chapter 2
Angel.
That was Darrell. I struggled to my feet, fighting back the hiss of pain as I moved my shoulder. Something was seriously messed up with it, but the pain faded, replaced by a dull stab of hunger, and not for regular food. Yep, definitely broken or torn up somehow. Darrell's face was a mask of shock and concern as he helped steady me, thankfully on my good side.
Jesus Christ, are you okay?
Yeah, I said with a wince. I hated to do the cliche thing and ask what the hell happened, but what the hell happened? My gaze swept the area, taking in the activity around the out-of-control pickup meets parked car mess down the street, but I was more interested in seeing if I could catch a glimpse of Philip anywhere. No sign of him, but I did see a tall blonde woman on the other side of the street, pointing a nice-looking camera at me and obviously taking pictures. I guess it had been a pretty spectacular moment. I looked back to Darrell. Did you see who knocked me out of the way?
I only saw the back of his head, Darrell said with a frown. Don't know why he took off like that. Dude saved your life.
His brows drew together in a dark glower.
I'd have been seriously pissed if that driver had creamed you.
Oh, I almost think you like me, I teased, managing a shaky smile. Darrell snorted.
Paperwork? Oh, my God, the paperwork,
he replied, but his eyes shone in relief that I was all right. I looked around for my phone, saw it about a dozen feet away, apparently still in one piece, and still working, I found to my relief. The screen had a bit of fuzz to it, but a hard shake took care of that.
You sure you're okay?
Darrell asked, hovering over me like a mother hen, a very large and intimidating mother hen. I nodded and did my best not to do anything that would require me to move my right arm. That shoulder was trashed. I'm good. Promise. I gave him a quick, tight smile. Let me get something out of the van real quick. I managed to extricate myself from his hovering long enough to get back to the van and snag my cooler out of the front seat. Hunger gnawed at me. I needed brains, and I needed them now. The parasite dulled the pain, but that meant resources were being depleted for healing. Fortunately, as long as brains were available, my zombie parasite did a speedy job of making repairs to physical damage. Without them, the damage would remain, and rot and brain-seeking desperation would soon follow. I pulled a water bottle containing a thick, sludgy drink from the cooler. Though I always told people it was a protein drink, in reality it was a delicious-to-me smoothie of chocolate milk and pureed brains. I chugged it like a frat boy at a kegger, then sighed in relief as my shoulder pulled itself back together with a familiar sensation of shifting and tingling. My senses remained muted and dull, another way the parasite conserved resources when I was low on brains, which told me I could have used another bottle. Fortunately, the one I had was enough to get me by until I could obtain more. I wasn't starving and nowhere near losing it to the point of cracking open heads. Of course, I then had to deal with the crazy driver aftermath. First, I had to give a statement to the cop who'd been manning the barricade, who'd also narrowly avoided being run over. Then I had to reassure both Ben and Darrell that I was fine, and no, I did not need to go to the hospital to get checked out. After that, a bit of shameless gawking on my part as I watched the belligerent driver get handcuffed and stuffed into the back of a police car. Finally, with all the bullshit out of the way, and Ben and Darrell reassured for the billionth time that I didn't need to go to the ER, I escaped to my van and headed toward the morgue. First thing I did once I got on the road was call Marcus, since, as my not-quite-boyfriend, I knew he'd want to know what had happened. Hey, I said as soon as he answered, did you know there's a zombie movie being filmed in town?
Sure did. High school zombie apocalypse, 2 exclamation points. Bunch of our guys are working security details there.
I chuckled at the 2 exclamation points business. If it ever came out in 3D, would it get a third? Yeah, I got called out for a death on the set this morning, and then almost got my own body bag when some idiot who wasn't paying attention to the whole road closed thing tried to run me over.
Wait, what?
He asked, alarm in his voice.
Are you all right?
Yeah, but only because Philip tackled me out of the way.
Who?
Philip, my zombie baby, remember? I'd filled him in on everything that had happened to me in that goddamn lab, but months down the road, there was no reason for him to remember the guy's name. I heard his intake of breath.
Shit. But wait, I don't understand. Was he attacking you?
No, I said. I mean, I'm pretty sure he wasn't. It sure as hell seemed like he was trying to keep me from being plowed by that car. And then he jumped up and ran the hell off.
That is seriously weird.
No kidding.
How are you doing? Hungry? You have anything with you?
I knew he meant brains, not burgers. I just sucked down a smoothie to fix up my shoulder, so I'm okay for now.
I'll bring more for you when I pick you up this afternoon.
We had a casual date set for when I got off work today, though he had yet to tell me what he had planned.
Can't have you falling to pieces on me now, can I?
That would suck, I said with a laugh.
Yeah. I kind of like your bits right where they are, you know?
I grinned. You like my bits?
Pretty much, yep.
Cool, I said. Bring me something to eat, and maybe later I'll let you touch my bits.
Now there's an incentive not to be late,
he said. You better not be, I said with a laugh. My bits and I will see you at 4. I hung up without giving him a chance to reply. It served him right for not telling me where he was taking me this afternoon. The rain began in earnest as I pulled up to the rear entrance of the coroner's office building, but I managed to get myself and the body inside without getting too wet, thanks to the recently installed new awning. No one else decided to die for the rest of my shift, which was damn nice, since I really didn't want to pick up a body in the rain. When Jerry came in at 4:05 to relieve me on body snatcher duty, I gladly turned the van keys over to him, grabbed my stuff, and headed outside to wait for Marcus. Rain drummed on the awning in a heavy staccato, and barely a minute later, Marcus pulled up in his bright blue Ford F-150 pickup. I gave him a broad smile as I climbed in. Right on time.
You know it, he said with a grin as he passed me a bottle. Now let's get those bits stable.
I took a long drink, then watched him as he drove. Ruggedly handsome with dark hair and eyes and a great smile, he was a damn good guy who happened to be the one who'd saved my life by turning me into a zombie. He'd also anonymously secured me a job at the coroner's office so I'd have a supply of brains and helped me establish myself in my new life as a zombie. Later, we had a few hot and heavy weeks as a couple before I backed off to get perspective and space. It was the whole business about zombifying me and extorting me into taking the morgue job that I needed the most perspective about. Pair that with some over-the-top protective bullshit and general treating me like a child, and I'd been damn close to washing my hands of him completely. But the truth was, Marcus had some really great qualities, and I did enjoy him. Therefore, after a number of very serious talks, I decided to mentally wipe the slate clean and start over. No point in holding a grudge for shit in the past, especially when his actions had totally saved my life and forced me to get my act together. Marcus had promised to try harder and actually get my input on things from now on, and I tried not to overthink anything and simply have fun. I finished off the bottle, exhaling in relief as the last tugs of hunger faded and the world came back into proper focus. Yeah, that's the good stuff. Marcus pulled a baggie of what looked like ugly gray banana chips out of the console and passed it to me.
Now try these.
I replaced the top on the bottle and stuck it in the drink holder, then gave the contents of the baggie a dubious sniff. I liked what I smelled, but they sure looked nasty. What are these? I asked, taking a cautious nibble.
Brain chips, he said. I got a dehydrator and thought I'd give it a try. Slice thin and let them dry. He shrugged. Only about half of the brain power they'd have if they were fresh or frozen, but no cooler needed, and they satisfy that crunch craving.
I took a bigger bite. I like. Marcus smiled, obviously pleased.
Keep those. I have more at home.
Cool. I ate another brain chip and then stuffed the bag down into my purse. Man, I feel sorry for those fake zombies who have to wear that makeup all day. Wonder how much it costs to pay all those people and stuff.
Dunno, Marcus replied. But I heard that these extras are making $100 to $150 a day, and that they gave first hiring priority to people who were laid off after Saberton Corp bought the farm machinery factory last fall.
Oh, wow, I said. That's pretty cool of them. The bigwigs at Saberton had sworn up, down, and sideways that the layoffs were temporary and that everyone would be rehired as soon as the company nailed down a major defense contract. But the contract had yet to come through, and several hundred people were either still out of a job or making do with whatever work they could scrounge. Marcus glanced my way.
Well, Uncle Pietro said that State Senator Jane Pennington really pushed for that.
Even cooler. Then I grinned. Is it wrong that I want to go hungry for a bit and then sneak in as an extra?
Probably, but who cares? He replied with a laugh.
He turned down the street that ran alongside the high school, not far from where I'd picked up the body, then pulled into the deserted back lot of the football stadium. I used to think my high school took their football seriously, but Tucker Point High supporters took it to a whole new level of absurd. After a ridiculously successful high-profile fundraising campaign a few years back, the alumni had built a sleek monstrosity that had to be the biggest, glitziest high school stadium in the Southeast.
We're here,
he announced as he parked close to the entrance and shut off the engine. The look I gave him was plenty dubious. Why are we here?
He grabbed a thick blanket from behind the seat.
Come on, I'll show you,
he said. And with no further hint, he climbed out and headed toward the darkened entrance.
Okay, I hurried to follow.
Behind me, the truck horn beeped as Marcus hit the remote lock.
Dude, this is kind of creepy, I said with a laugh.
He reached back and took my hand.
In a few minutes, you won't be thinking about creepy.
Well, that can be taken a bunch of different ways, I replied.
Marcus broke into a run as the light rain abruptly increased in intensity, then pulled me close as soon as we were under shelter.
So can you,
he murmured. A thrill shot through me. Marcus and I had our ups and downs, but we had some serious chemistry in the bedroom.
Oh, wow, I said with an unsteady grin.
His mouth nuzzled my neck.
You're in trouble now. I'm primed.
So that's why you wanted me to eat the chips.
I rolled my eyes, but I couldn't help but laugh. Back at his house, he had a brain pudding that he'd nicknamed Foreplay. Never a good idea to risk falling apart during zombie sex.
Ew.
Marcus chuckled as he took my hand again and headed down a passageway.
I'm no fool.
I peered around as we walked.
Are we allowed to be here?
Sure,
he said in a very unconvincing tone of voice.
Didn't have to climb any fences, did we?
We wound our way through a dim passageway beneath the seating, then up a set of concrete stairs onto a covered walkway that ran around the perimeter of the stadium.
This sure is, romantic, I said, casting him a dubious look.
Didn't know you were looking for romance,
he said, still grinning as we stepped out onto the bleachers.
Come on,
he urged as he began to climb.
You're so weird, I said, but I went with him.
You mean besides being a zombie?
He said, shooting me an amused glance over his shoulder.
Well, yeah, I said, grinning. That zombie shit's old hat now.
We reached the top of the stairs, and I allowed Marcus to lead me behind the scoreboard, then up a narrow ladder to a hidden alcove above the walkway. He let go of my hand and spread out the thick blanket. I looked out over the empty stadium from our lofty vantage. State of the art, no doubt about that. From the swanky all-glass press box to the perfect grass on the field with Tucker Point emblazoned in the end zones, it screamed, "We obsess way too hard over high school football, and don't you forget it."
Okay, I said. This is kind of cool.
His gaze went out to the view.
Not so creepy up here.
I sat down on the blanket.
Well, you are a zombie, so automatically creepy.
Wait,
he protested.
A few seconds ago, the zombie aspect was old hat.
He stripped off his damp shirt and dropped it to the concrete.
I think you just say stuff that's convenient in the moment.
Yeah? You don't seem to mind too much.
I leaned back on my elbows and admired the view,
and not the one out in the stadium. For a sort of dead guy, you're pretty hot.
Marcus flexed his right bicep.
I eat my brainies.
He unbuttoned his jeans, then struck a deliberately ridiculous muscle pose.
Oh, my God, I laughed. Cut that out and come show my bits what your brainies do for you.
He proceeded to show me in great detail exactly what his brainies could do for my bits, paying special attention to certain bits to my great delight. No matter what else I might have been unsure about with the two of us, there was no denying that the sex rocked. Marcus was attentive, fun, creative, and always made sure I got off. And he was even great about doing the whole cuddling after stuff, too.
You like that?
He murmured as he held me close. I gave him the smile of a very sexually satisfied woman. My bits are happy. He chuckled low and gave me a light squeeze. I rested my head on his chest and listened to the thump of his heart.
I think I kind of like this adventure dating thing, I said.
Marcus was quiet for a moment.
I think I kind of miss waking up next to you in the mornings.
The statement brought a warm rush of pleasure, along with a chaser of guilt and a splash of frustration. We'd been dating, really actually dating, for about 6 months now. I wanted to keep the pace super slow, and he wanted us to be, well, an actual honest-to-God couple. But after the long, slogging mess of my previous relationship with Randy the Loser,
I wanted to be sure everything was right before getting too caught up in things like spending the night and moving in together and whatever else might come after that. I also wanted to be sure that we were together because we were actually compatible and not simply because we were both zombies. I slid a hand over his chest. It was a damn nice chest. Yeah, but I like that we're taking the time to really get to know each other.
And you don't think that can happen the other way?
He asked. To his credit, there was only the faintest whisper of disappointment in his voice. Marcus, it's different, okay? I said with a low sigh. Tilting my head back, I looked up into his face. Yeah, we'd get to know each other if I spent the night with you or lived with you, but... I trailed off with a grimace, wishing I could explain it better. I just think it's too soon. He couldn't completely mask the letdown, but he smiled and kissed me.
Okay, I can take a hint. Or a 2x4, he added with a slightly forced chuckle.
Damn it. Marcus, I'm not saying it'll never happen. But why couldn't he understand? Sure, 6 months was a long time, but we were both, well, we had the potential to live a damn long time, and I didn't want to screw this up.
It's all right, babe, he said.
And for a moment, I could almost believe that it was.
One day at a time, he continued. I can do that.
I snuggled close, and he tightened his arm around me. The warm air and the drumming of rain on the metal roof lulled us both into boneless relaxation. Safe and content for the moment, I closed my eyes and allowed myself to drift into a doze.
It doesn't make sense.
Footsteps and a man's low voice penetrated my light snooze. I opened my eyes, heart pounding, as I got my bearings. For a moment, I was certain that someone had discovered us in our little sex nook, but the only person in sight was Marcus, eyes closed and clearly in a far deeper sleep.
No way that support fell on its own,
the speaker continued, sounding frustrated and annoyed. He was below us, I realized, on the walkway.
I was on that scaffold yesterday. Everything was solid.
Forget it, another man said. Doesn't matter now. Sucks to lose Stuart, but be glad it happened before everything else got going. Can you imagine cops crawling around later this week? The first man replied, but they'd moved off and I couldn't hear it. Marcus, I said softly as I gently shook him. He blinked awake, focused on my face and smiled.
Hey, babe, sorry. Didn't mean to fall asleep. I guess I was too comfy cuddled up with you.
There are people here, I said. I mean, down on the walkway. I think they're from the movie. He kissed me, then sat up and reached for his shirt.
Not surprised. The big finale zombie attack scene is going to be filmed down on the field in a few days.
His voice was briefly muffled as he tugged his shirt over his head.
They're probably figuring out lighting and cameras and stuff.
My jeans and undies were close by, and I began to tug them on. They were talking about the guy who died, I told him. It sounded like they didn't think it was an accident, that the pipe shouldn't have fallen the way it did. He stood and pulled on underwear and pants.
Probably want to be sure they don't get blamed for it.
He glanced my way.
Insurance company will check it all out, I'm sure, and Ben's thorough,
he added, referring to Detective Roth. I slipped my shirt over my head, ran my fingers through my hair. Okay, but then one of them said it was good it happened now before everything else started so there wouldn't be cops around. I leveled a frown at Marcus. Explain that. Marcus grinned.
Filming, he stated. They're in rehearsals and pre-production now. They actually begin filming with the leads in the morning. I suppose it would be a pain in the butt to try and film with a police investigation going on.
Damn you for making sense, I said, lightly smacking him on the chest. He pulled me close for a kiss.
I always make perfect sense,
he said with a chuckle, then glanced out at the sky.
Rain's letting up. We should probably get going.
Taking his hand, I let him lead the way back down and out of the stadium. Then together we dashed through the lingering drizzle to his truck. I fought back a yawn as he drove me back to the morgue and my car. As nice as the date had been, even with the slight strangeness at the end, I couldn't deny I was ready to get home and chill for a while before bed. He pulled up next to my car, and I was about to say my goodbyes when Marcus reached into the console and pulled out an envelope.
I have a surprise for you, he said with a smile. Compliments of Uncle Pietro.
I took the envelope he offered and pulled out two tickets to the Gourmet Gala, a swanky annual charity event I'd never even dreamed of attending. Damn near every restaurant in the parish participated, each with a booth or table where they gave out free samples of all sorts of fine cuisine. Tickets were expensive as hell, which meant that all the movers and shakers and rich people made sure to be seen there. I didn't give a crap about being seen. I just wanted the food. I stared at the tickets. You're serious? Your uncle simply gave these to you?
Yeah, sure, he said, lifting his shoulders in a shrug. He passes stuff like this my way now and then.
You've gone to this before?
He smiled. A couple of times in the past few years.
And we're really going tomorrow night?
Marcus snorted, pretty obviously amused by my enthusiasm. That's the plan, if you want to. And judging by the gleam in your eyes, I'd say it was a yes.
Okay, it's possible that I gave a squeal of excitement worth of a teen girl at a Justin Bieber concert. Oh my God, I have to find something to wear.
Marcus laughed. You have time, don't sweat it.
I gaped at him in horror. Easy for you to say. You have a closet full of clothes, and you're a guy.
Okay, okay, he said, grinning. Just make sure you get something with elastic in the waistband. Lots and lots of food.
I'll undo the top button. Not a problem.
Sounds good to me.
He leaned over and gave me a kiss, which I didn't mind returning.
Go veg out, and I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Sure thing, I said, giving him a smile as I climbed out of the truck. He waited until I had my car started before driving off.
Good dude.
Yet on the way home, my thoughts went back to the weirdness on the movie set this morning. What the hell was Philip doing there? And why save me from a world of hurt and then run away? He was tied in with Dr. Christy Cherish, which left me more than a little unsettled. I didn't want that psycho bitch anywhere near me. There was only one person I could think of who might have some answers. Pietro Ivanov. He'd thrown me to the wolves a few months ago when he'd allowed Cherish to kidnap me, but had since admitted he'd screwed up and had done a lot to try and make up for it. Like the pardon. About 2 years ago, I'd been arrested for possession of stolen property while driving a car my loser ex-boyfriend had insisted was a totally legit purchase and ended up with probation and suspended sentence and a felony on my record. But shortly after I managed to pull off my escape from Cherish's secret lab, my probation officer let me know that I wasn't on probation anymore because I'd been pardoned. Totally clean record. Fresh start. And I had no doubt Pietro was responsible. As well as being the head of the local zombie mafia, he was rich as hell and had a zillion political connections. No one else who gave a shit about me had the power to pull off a full pardon from the frickin' governor. No way did I trust Pietro yet, or forgive him for that matter, but there was certainly a truce and potential to rebuild. There was no sign of my dad when I got home, but since it was barely 7 p.m., I figured I could hold off worrying that he was out drinking. He never drank at the house anymore, probably because he knew I sure as hell didn't approve. And to his credit, he was pretty damn careful about not drinking and driving. Unfortunately, that was primarily because a few months ago, Mr. Jimmy Crawford got stopped for driving while intoxicated. Fortunately, it was Marcus who had pulled him over. And even though Marcus bent rules like crazy and called me to come get my dad, saving us from tons of hassle and thousands of dollars, the incident pretty much shattered the shaky peace the two men had made, and my dad had gone right back to an active dislike of that cop. Scowling in annoyance and frustration with the whole situation, I slugged down about half a bottle of brain smoothie to make up for what I'd burned off in my exertions with Marcus, then flopped onto the sagging couch to watch TV. I woke later to screeching laughter on some nighttime talk show. A glance at the clock told me I'd crashed for a solid 4 hours, which meant that now I could worry about my dad's drinking. Not that worrying did a damn bit of good, or arguing, or lecturing, or yelling. I knew that. I could wait for him, brace myself for an argument, or worse, when he finally came through the door. And for what? It wouldn't accomplish a damn thing. I shut off the TV and went on to bed, unsure whether to be upset or relieved that he still wasn't home. Chapter 3
5 days and counting,
Nick said with a smile. I could only groan. For the past few months, Nick, my oftentimes annoying but basically good-hearted co-worker, had been tutoring me for the GED, the high school equivalency exam. Passing it had been a condition of my probation, but then I'd received my mysterious pardon, and suddenly I didn't have to pass the GED. Except that I did, for my own self-respect. Hell, having any self-respect at all was a new experience for me, so why not go full tilt, right? Besides, I'd learned that zombies had the potential to live a very long time. Living 100 years or so as an uneducated loser wasn't all that appealing to me. Therefore, the first step was to get my damn high school diploma. However, being chock full of self-respect didn't mean I wasn't totally intimidated by the whole process. I'm not ready, I said, looking with dismay at the pile of workbooks that Nick had forced me to plow through in the past months. There's no way. His green eyes narrowed.
You won't be if you keep saying that. You went through the practice test last week and did pretty well, and you've been studying your ass off since then.
I took a deep breath. Right. Okay. I can do this. But then my self-confidence wilted. I'm still so damn slow on the reading part, though. I'm afraid I'll run out of time.
And you get slower when you're flustered, he pointed out for about the billionth time. So, you need to keep focused on what's right in front of you and not on what's left to do.
At least I'm good at the math part, I said. Too bad I had to get passing grades on all of it. Math, science, reading, writing, and social studies. But it was only the reading part that had me worried sick. Nick leaned back and gave me a considering look.
Have you ever been tested for dyslexia? I mean, it's not that you aren't smart enough or don't understand the words.
I blinked at him.
Isn't that the thing where you see words backwards or something? I don't think I have that.
He shook his head.
It's not always like that. Dyslexia can show up in lots of ways. Sometimes it's only noticed because reading is slow for no other apparent reason. Then testing can be done to determine if that's the cause.
Well, what difference would it make at this point? I asked with a slight frown. I mean, I read slow as molasses, not sure anything can be done about that.
Not much to be done about the slow reading right now. But if you get diagnosed, you can probably get extra time for the test.
Oh, wow. I blew out a breath. Now that would make it worthwhile.
Even if I didn't end up needing the extra time, it would take my stress level down by a fair amount.
No kidding, he said. I don't know how long it takes to get tested and diagnosed and all, but it'd be worth looking into.
He tilted his head. And you could get tutoring to specifically address whatever issues you have.
I have lots of issues, I said with a laugh. He grinned.
Yes, you do.
It was an interesting thought. Could it be that easy? And if it really was something like that, then why hadn't any of my teachers noticed it and done something about it? Or maybe they did, I realized. A whisper of memory intruded, of being pulled out of class when I was in fourth or fifth grade to go to the school office and do all sorts of reading and comprehension tests for a round-cheeked woman. It was more than possible that the school had contacted my mother to let her know I had a problem, and she'd simply never pursued it. She sure as hell wouldn't have exerted any extra effort for me, and my dad had been working on an offshore oil rig at the time. He wouldn't have known there was a problem. The pieces fell into place.
Damn. Had my mother really done that? It made a sick sense. The testing, all the problems in school, everything. A wave of anger passed through me. I wouldn't put it past her. If it didn't revolve around her, she had no use for it. And damn it, though she was dead and buried and couldn't hit me anymore, this reading thing still had me in its grip. I needed to know what that testing had been about, and maybe even get a black and white answer about whether or not my mom had blown off the test results. With a mental sigh, I added, check school records to my list of things to do. Probably too late to get diagnosed or whatever before the test this weekend,
I said, trying to throw off the cloud of my mother's neglect. But after I fail this one, I'll look into it. I knew I'd said the wrong thing the instant the words left my mouth. For a guy who wasn't much taller than me, Nick could be pretty intimidating when he got angry. His mouth tightened to a thin line. If you're so sure you're going to fail, why even bother? He stood and picked up the workbook, dropped it onto the others with a thud. I sighed and tugged a hand through my hair. Okay, I'm not sure I'm gonna fail, I winced. I don't do well on tests like that. He wasn't appeased. Well, shit. So far, you've told me you're not ready, you're going to fail, and you don't do well on tests like this. From what I've seen, you were close to ready a week ago. You were within a few points of passing the practice test, and you did perfectly fine taking that one. If you're not careful, you'll talk yourself into being a living, breathing, self-fulfilling prophecy. The words hung in the air of the morgue. Nick had gone from being a pain in my ass and a pompous jerk to being someone I could actually confess my insecurities to. We weren't quite friends, at least not the sort of friend I'd hang out or see a movie with, but I trusted him, and I knew he had my back. It was almost as if he'd decided that since I wasn't a threat to any of his own ambitions, he was going to do his best to help me with my own. And I like to think that his association with me helped unprickify him a bit, which might even have helped him finally score his recent promotion to death investigator. I'm scared, I admitted, dropping my head into my hands. I've worked really hard to not be such a damn loser anymore, you know? Nick moved behind me. A couple of seconds later, I felt his hand on my shoulder in an almost hesitant touch. You don't need to be scared, Angel, he urged. You don't have to do this for anyone but yourself anymore. Worst thing that can happen, the absolute worst, is that you'll need to retest. He gave my shoulder a light squeeze. Compare that to all the other bad shit that can happen in one day, and maybe it won't be so scary after all. I turned my head to look up at him, gave him a smile. You're right. Thanks. I knew all too well how much bad shit could happen in one day, and failing a test wasn't even on the same scale. It's really not the end of the world if I fail. Nope, it's not. Then he put on a grumpy expression. Except that you'd have to spend that much more time with me. That should be motivation enough to pass. I laughed and gave a mock shudder. Oh, God help me. Yep, you're in trouble. Then he cleared his throat and lifted his hand from my shoulder as if he'd suddenly remembered he was maintaining the contact. Enough moaning. I've got work to do. Yeah, moved up in the world from body snatcher to big bad investigator, I said with a smile. It's about damn time they recognize my worth, he said, only half kidding as he headed out and back to the main building. I rolled my eyes and bent my head to continue studying. About half an hour later, Alan Prejean, chief investigator for the St. Edward's Parish Sheriff's Office, walked past the door of the office, gave me a sour look, and made a point of checking his watch as he passed. Scowling, I deliberately waited another minute before putting all my books away. I still had 3 minutes before my shift technically started. I wasn't stupid enough to do my tutoring and studying on company time. Or rather, I wasn't stupid enough to do so in front of Alan. I studied in the van or in the morgue late at night all the damn time. Alan had worked for the coroner, Dr. Duplessis, for close to 15 years, long before Duplessis was elected. As a former paramedic who was studying to be a physician's assistant, he'd supposedly already been offered a position with Dr. Duplessis's private cardiology practice once he graduated, and that day couldn't come soon enough for me. Alan certainly knew his stuff when it came to death investigation, and he ran the office well enough, but he was also a dick. His call schedule seemed to be set up specifically to inconvenience me as much as possible, and he made no effort to be discreet about my drug history when requiring job-related piss tests, which I somehow ended up randomly selected for every damn month. There was no doubt he disliked me intensely, though I didn't know whether it was a simple thing of not liking me because of my felony, pill-popping, loser background, or if there was some other, more specific reason. I knew he'd love to find an excuse to fire me,
So I did my damnedest to keep my nose clean, obey every goddamn rule, and go the extra mile when needed. And not simply because I needed this job for the access it gave me to my brain food supply, but more because there was no way I was letting Alan Prejean win. After getting my books and notes packed up, I left my borrowed study space and headed through the building to the morgue. The only body scheduled to be autopsied was head-squished guy from the movie set, and after garbing myself in scrubs, shoe covers, plastic smock, paper apron over that, hair cover, and latex gloves, I made quick work of getting him out of the cooler and into the cutting room. Sometimes it cracked me up to go through the whole rigmarole of protecting myself from biohazards. I sure as hell didn't need to worry about hepatitis or HIV, since my parasite took care of that. There'd been plenty of times when I'd eaten brains straight from the body bag while still protectively garbed. Another one of those things I did by the book, since ignoring safety protocols was a fireable offense. Blood from Mr. Brent Stewart's smushed head had pooled in a sticky mess inside the bag, and when I pulled him from the stretcher onto the metal table, the bag slid as well as poured a gooey stream of blood onto the floor. I let out a bunch of nasty words, sopped up as much as I could with towels, which then went straight into the biohazard container, then fetched the mop and bucket to get the rest of it up before Dr. LeBlanc arrived. I barely finished emptying the bucket out and putting the cleaning stuff away when the pathologist came in. "Shit, sorry, Doc," I said as I hurried back to the cutting room. "Had a blood spill, and I don't have your tools set out. Give me 5 minutes, and I'll be ready for you."
"Not a problem, Angel."
Dr. LeBlanc was in his 50s with thin, blonde gray hair and sharp blue eyes that often sparkled with humor. He was unimposing physically, medium height and build with a bit of flab around the waist, but I knew he was tough as nails when it came to standing up for what he believed in.
"You've spoiled me by usually having everything ready half an hour before I've even finished my morning coffee."
His eyes crinkled as he smiled at me.
"In fact, I don't think I've ever seen you running late before. Is everything all right?"
"Yep," I replied as I set out his implements. Scalpels, scissors, saw, forceps, rib shears, syringes. I was studying in the investigator's office, had another tutoring session with Nick this morning.
"Ah, of course. 5 more days.
He pulled smock and apron on, tugged on gloves.
"Nick's been helpful?"
"Oh my God, more than helpful," I said fervently. "There's no way I could afford to pay a tutor for the amount of time he's worked with me. And he's actually really good at teaching this stuff. I mean, he's not, his usual self." Dr. LeBlanc's eyes flashed with amusement. He knew exactly what I meant. There was a good reason why I usually mentally referred to Nick as Nick the Prick.
"You make him want to be a better person," he said with only a trace of facetiousness.
I responded with a soft snort of derision. "Hardly. I think he simply enjoys the challenge of filling my blank slate." I shook my head. "Anyway, it's pretty amazing he's willing to help. A year ago, I'd never have imagined I'd have so many awesome people supporting me."
"You were just waiting for your moment to shine," he replied.
He moved to the table and peered down at Mr. Stewart, assessing. "Helps that I had so many people giving me a hand up along the way," I said with a shrug. He glanced up at me.
"That only works if you have your hand up and reaching."
"Well, that's damn near poetic," I said with a laugh. He gave an answering grin.
"I blame the formalin fumes."
He picked up a scalpel.
"Let's find out if there was anything amiss about Mr. Stewart's death."
Except for the crushed nature of Mr. Stewart's head, he seemed to have been in excellent health. The autopsy went quickly, and I drew and packaged up blood, urine, and vitreous samples for later toxicology testing. The conversation I overheard at the stadium about the death possibly not being an accident replayed itself in the back of my mind, and the autopsy didn't help put it to rest. While Dr. LeBlanc had no problem listing the blunt force head trauma as the cause of death due to the extent of the crushing damage, he fully admitted there was little way to determine if it had been accidental or intentional. After he finished and left to go write up his notes, I returned Mr. Stewart to the cooler. It bothered me that we might never find out if he'd been murdered, though I knew there'd be slim chance the killer would ever be found and prosecuted, even if we knew for sure. Lots of murders went unsolved, and I had no doubt there were plenty of accidental deaths that weren't, or overdoses that had been helped along. I guess all we can do is the best we can, I decided. The rest of my